Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks, with more than 60,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. You know, there used to be only two ways to meet for business, over the phone or in person. Now there's a better way. Use GoToMeeting to meet online. With GoToMeeting, everyone sees your computer desktop on their computer screen, so you get the best of both worlds. It's like meeting in person, but without wasting time and money traveling. And your conference calls will be more effective. The best part is that you can actually try it for free. That's right, GoToMeeting is free right now for 30 days. For this special offer, you must visit www.gotomeeting.com/podcasts. That's gotomeeting.com/podcasts for a free trial.
Well, hello and welcome to the Disciplined Investor Podcast, episode number 149. This is Andrew Horowitz, and I hope that you have been having a little bit of fun, taking some time off. It's back from President's Day weekend, that elongated time, that great weekend where we've had a few of them recently. We spent a little bit less time on the markets, a little less time on business, a little more time with family and friends. So hopefully you had an opportunity to do so. I have a couple of things to talk about today, and then I want to talk about, just introduce you to our guest that we're going to be bringing on. But basically, I'm going to talk a little bit about what happened at the end of the week and really focus in on what's going on forward and what is meant by some of the possible, what are the implications of the rate hike that we saw for the discount rate on Friday. And then also, I want to mention to you that it is your last chance pretty much if you want to call in and you want to actually ask a question on the special episode number 150. The number to call in is 954-828-2977. And just leave a message, leave your name, and we'll cut that right into the next show. Again, it's 954-828-2977. And today, just to let you know who's coming up, first up, we're going to have Damon Southward. He is the gentleman who oversees a team of fundamental and technical analysts at Briefing.com. This is the head honcho, and I hope to really find out more about what his insights are and what he's seeing from his aspect and his aspect of the markets. And that should be very interesting. Also, we have bringing back Satyajit Das, who is he's a good friend, an incredible analyst when it comes to the world markets and finance and derivatives. We had him on before. A lot of people really enjoyed it. Got a lot of great emails on that. But we're bringing him back to talk about two things. One is his recent piece that he wrote called The Botox Economy. And then we're also going to talk about the Greek tragedy that's going on right now and the stuff that happens in Europe that's causing all sorts of reverberations around world markets. So let's just take a minute and talk about what happened. Last week was amazing. We saw this incredible turnaround out of thin air. Markets were looking like they were stabilizing, looking like maybe they're going to drift a little bit lower. Then all of a sudden we come in on Tuesday and out of nowhere, for really no reason, there was no economic reason, economic reports, no financial innuendo, there was no discussion. All of a sudden we see this huge rally on Tuesday. Now, there's been a variety of reports that have shown that almost on any Monday, pretty much 16 out of the last 19 or 20 have been up days and pretty good up days for the markets. Whether or not people have been pulling out their money at the end of the week and looking for something to happen over the weekend and the relief rallies then ensue on Monday or whatever it may be is kind of an interesting phenomenon. But nonetheless, we saw this rally and then a follow through throughout the week when it looked like there was really nothing again that would really be beneficial for the U.S. markets. In fact, we also saw that we saw a PPI number come in that was pretty hot on Thursday. And we saw a jobs number that was disappointing. None of that seemed to matter. We saw some, I guess, both sides of the earnings equation. Hewlett-Packard came in looking pretty good. Walmart came in looking pretty miserable. Dell came in looking pretty miserable. And overall, we've seen that the there's been this incredible volatility when it comes to the currency markets. The euro, again, was just getting thrashed around throughout the week against the dollar. So on Friday, we find out, actually Thursday night after the market closes, right after the market closes on Thursday, really weird timing, especially due to the fact that Friday was options expiration. And the Fed decides to surprisingly increase the discount rate. Now, oftentimes you see that they'll start moving in small, little bitty increments. And in this case, it was the discount rate, not the Fed funds rate, simply the discount rate. Now, what's interesting about that is it was meant to be, so it seems and it appears, that it was to take a little bit of money out of the market to make the banks go to private funding rather than the Fed to obtain their funding. And one of the reasons may be to slow down some of the speculation on many of the instruments that they've been using their monies for to shore up the banks further. The signal it may have given, even though the world sold off after the announcements, futures were down significantly, and we saw a big sell-off in the Asian region, Europe came back. Europe did very well, actually, and then the U.S. markets did an incredible turnaround on Friday, and the banking sector in particular did pretty well. All that can be said is that it is a sign, a signal that the economy is on the mend, and that's what the Fed is showing. Now, one of the things we've been doing very successfully of late is to be working the oil trade back and forth, because one of the beneficiaries or the problems that will arise from a very swiftly moving currency market is that oil will also, and material companies will also move back and forth very dramatically. So I want you to consider looking at oil and some of the metals right now as a trading play. In other words, something that you'll move in and out of. And the other thing that looks very, very, almost to a point of delicious, is some of the coal companies. We talked about them last week in the Monday edition of Indicators We're Watching. And I'll mention it again to you that coal companies look pretty interesting right now. The other thing I'll mention to you is last week we put up a stochastics crossing up screen on the podcast. I'll link to that again so you can take a look at that. But first, let me just tell you something about Audible, one of our great sponsors. I think this is something you'll be really interested in. I'm going to give you a great idea on a book that you may really like. One of the bestsellers from the New York Times. And for all the listeners of this podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook to give you a chance to try out the service. So how about the book Super Freakonomics, which is written by Stephen Levitt and Stephen Dubner, and it's read by Stephen Dubner, in fact. The author examines how consumers and businesses respond to incentives using a super freaky mix of smart thinking and great storytelling. All you have to do to get your copy of this or any book of your choice is go to audiblepodcast.com/investor. audiblepodcast.com/investor. When we get back, we're going to bring up our two guests and start talking some real good stuff, information about the global economies and some information on briefing. I got some really good questions for Damon. All right, so my first guest today is Damon Southward, and he oversees a team of fundamental, technical, and special situations analysts over at briefing.com. Now, I've talked about briefing a lot, and I've also, if you noticed, that on thedisciplinedinvestor.com, we use references from briefing and their materials quite often. And it's really just a great product. We're going to talk a little bit about this. But Damon oversees about two dozen people, and he's managing a team that works across an entire spectrum of their services. So we're going to talk to him. So Damon, how are you?
Oh, well, how about yourself?
I'm great, thanks.
Thanks for having me on.
Hey, my pleasure. This is great stuff, because I know for a while we've been trying to get somebody from briefing. So I wanted to set this up because there's so much information. I always say it's like trying to get a sip of water out of an open fire hydrant these days, right? Stuff is coming from left and right. So I thought maybe we'd start with, if you could just give us a little visual of what the room, the trading or the information floor looks like at briefing, because I'm kind of interested, and I think that our listeners will be really interested in that. And then we'll get into a discussion of some of the economics and some of the things that are going on.
Okay. I mean, first, our base level product is Briefing and Play, and it's a filtered news feed with live market intelligence. So essentially, we go through the thousands of press releases that are issued every day, the thousands of various news reports, and essentially filter them for the most actionable information, the information that we think investors or traders would be interested in. And so instead of them having to sit in front of a PR news wire or business wire or a news feed literally reading every story, we do that for them and have a team of people in here scanning those wires.
So how do you, you know, here's what happens. You get the PR, which slash BS a lot of times comes from the companies. Let's be honest, right? I mean, there's a lot of fluff in there.
Yeah, definitely.
Definitely a lot of fluff. How do we make sure, or how do you make sure that the information, and we'll call it filtering process, that comes from the company, then it goes to their PR group, then ends up on your desk, ends up at an analyst, and then kind of flows through. How is that all kind of, I guess, vetted is the right word, to make sure that the information is, you know, unopinionated and factual?
Well, we do a lot of background work in preparation for events. I mean, there are predictable events such as earnings releases where we, in advance, we go in and, you know, gather a consensus estimate, gather metrics such as gross margins, EBITDA, you know, bookings. I mean, the stuff that really matters to the institutional community that the retail community might not necessarily pay attention to. I mean, mm-hmm. as I think most people starting off when they begin trading or investing, they see that Apple reports a 20-cent beat in revenues or above consensus and what we call the headline number, which you'll see come across most financial news channels, and people get excited and think, wow, what a, you know, it's an awesome quarter. You know, what we're actually paying attention to are the metrics that institutions are going to be making decisions on, such as, you know, did gross margin come in above or below expectations? Because you may have a situation where a company blows out their number, but gross margin is disappointed, or the tax rate was lower than analysts had modeled, and so that provided all of the upside. And those are situations where professional traders can take advantage of the retail market because they don't know which numbers to pay attention to.
Right.
And so when you get that retail money that comes flying into the stock on a headline news event, professional traders are actually looking at other bits of information that will help them make a decision on how the stock should respond.
Right, because I remember that during the beginning of this earnings season, there was a particular stock that came. I think it was Alcoa. If not, it was, who was the first? IBM comes out early, right? I forgot.
Alcoa comes out very early.
Yeah, it was the first one.
First major name.
Right, I think it was them. They were looking for like a 70%. I just can't remember if it was them or somebody else. But anyway, it was this company. They were looking for a 70% margin. And it was like, you know, kind of a crazy number. And it was looking at the end cycle. Oh, I think it was Intel. And they were looking at about a 70-something percent or so. And that was the big thing to be watching when the earnings came out. What was the margins going to be? I think they even came out with a ridiculous like 75%. Something ridiculous. And, mm-hmm. and why did the stock trade down, everybody's thinking? And the conventional thinking would be that the stock would trade up because they beat, and they beat the heck out of the margin number, right? But unfortunately, everybody said, this is the best it's ever going to get. Right? That's kind of like what happened.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, there was a lot baked into Intel. Analysts were very positive going into the quarter. So we actually, you know, we'll do earnings previews of the major names and actually try to provide a level of sentiment out there so that you know that, okay, well, and one of the things you've been saying that a lot of people might not be aware of is analysts have been extremely conservative with their numbers.
Right.
So even going into an earnings report, they might put out a note saying, hey, we expect the company to beat by 20%, but they don't raise the estimates. You know, a couple of years ago, I mean, before the financial meltdown, a lot of times they would actually raise the estimate. And but I guess they figured out there's really no upside to that.
Right, exactly.
So it's better to have the company beat, the stock potentially do well, and everyone be happy. So, so even though estimates might not be raised and a company blows out the number, sentiment going into the report essentially reflects an estimate increase. So right. everyone knows, okay, this company's going to beat by a bunch. I'm going to buy it in advance. And with Intel, you saw it had a nice run-up into its earnings report.
Right, which it could be, you know, it's as simple as this, that everybody saw the last two quarters of earnings come out, and it was like, great, you know, and the stock release, whether it was Intel or other stocks, blew up after earnings. Everybody said, you know, in a good way, moved up, I should say, and everybody wanted to get in ahead of it, but then what happened was it kind of got a little bit too heady. But can I ask you a question about economists? I'm having a problem. Analysts are one thing. I think I understand, at least conceptually, what the story is with analysts, in that with an analyst, you know, oftentimes during the bad times, during the very good times, I should say, and these are some studies that have been done out of a couple of different universities, and we had the gentleman on that did this. During good times, analysts are overstating and overestimating, and in bad times, they're understating and underestimating. Okay, let's just let that go for a second. And right now, they're kind of trying to save their skins after being so wrong a year and a half ago. What's with the economists? I mean, I don't know about you, but it seems that these guys couldn't hit a broadside of the barn lately. Am I wrong?
I don't know. I mean, I think you have, first of all, I think you have a couple camps of economists. You have the, you know, the camps of, you know, the guys who work, or the individuals who work for people with real money on the line, and if they're not good, they get fired and you get a better one. And then you have the camp of people who aren't necessarily held to the standard of you better be right. And just with anything, if you look at an individual company in terms of, you know, analysts' projections on estimates, whether they have a buy, hold, sell rating, but everyone has a different opinion, and there are various factors that go into creating that opinion. But I think that in many cases, at some shops, you know, analysts that don't perform well, they get let go. And I think a lot of it is based on the type of institutions that you're focused on. So, I mean, I would say that the economist at Goldman Sachs, I mean, is highly regarded, and you know, people are going to pay a lot of attention to, but his calls aren't necessarily separated from the analyst at the economist at some mid-tier brokerage shop that right. doesn't necessarily have a sparkling reputation.
Right.
It's essentially an average of, you know, dozens of economists out there, and their performance isn't necessarily taken into account.
Well, let's be honest. What Goldman says happens. I mean, yeah. Come on. I mean, how could you get, you know, that? I remember the 2 quarters ago when they came out with the employment number, and they were just like way outside the range of everybody else, and they were spot on. And it was like the day before. That was when, if I remember correctly, that was that quarter when they were upgraded also by Meredith Whitney. But, you know, Goldman has been, whether they have a knack for it or whether they have... I don't want to go there. Let's just leave that out. So what's the story with? I want this picture though. So your room, your analyst room. You got screens everywhere, right? You got feeds. You got like a Bloomberg. Maybe you have a Thomson unit. You got press releases coming in. You got TVs on. You're monitoring the whole thing, right?
Yeah, definitely. I
mean, oh, that must be fun.
A room full of people out here looking at a variety of things. You know, most of these people have, you know, 4 or 5 screens going, looking at, you know, technicals, looking at news, looking at, different filters they've created and screens. I mean, just a variety of looking at SEC file. I mean, any type of catalyst driven, volatility driven, piece of news or information we have in front of us.
I got to come in there and play one day. That sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah.
You know? But no, we have the same thing. We know one of the things that we put up in our office is we have the dual in play. You used to have a different thing. It was like a 4-part way back, and it used to be like the headlines times 4 you could do. But now you have this dual in play where on the left-hand side, for example, you have just the economic news, if I want to put it that way. The right-hand side may be just news on stocks in my portfolio, as an example. And then it just streams throughout the day. Or you could have just technical trading, or you can have the beta trader, you can have the scalp trader, any of the people that, you know, you have a lot of names for people there. So that's really great. And by the way, I would say there's also a free site to briefing.com for just kind of a taste of some of the data. And that stays free all the time, I know. Not the easiest to get to. We'll put some links on there. But I would encourage anybody, if you spend like $40 a month, it's like nothing for the, I think that's what it is or something like that, for the lowest platform, it's just, you're not going to get any better. But that's enough of a plug for right now. So the economy, from what you're seeing, are, you know, it's better, of course, than it was. But is it, you know, a lot of people in the administration are touting this whole, you know, created or saved crap where they've saved all these jobs and 2 million jobs. I'm not buying all that. But are we actually getting better? Is there a chance for a double dip? Is this just an inventory restocking cycle? What's the play now?
I think there are, when you say play, I mean, see, there are a lot of plays out there in terms of short-term opportunities in the market. In terms of the outlook, I can't say I'm all that bullish. I mean, my personal opinion is that, standard of living has to fall for U.S. citizens, and that taxes are going up, and in order to dig our way out of this national debt, these deficits, we're going to have to make some hard choices. And I don't think that is necessarily good for, the economy, jobs, et cetera. So, we've enjoyed a very nice standard of living the past, many decades, several decades. And I think that, essentially, you have to pull back a little bit there. So, yeah, I can't say I'm the most optimistic about the overall economic outlook in the U.S.
But at the same time, nobody seemed to have told the consumers that they can't spend, from the readings that we're getting on the economics.
Well, you have to have a hobby, don't you? I mean, you can't just sit in the house and stare at the wall. I mean, I think, we U.S. consumers want to spend. That's what we do as a pastime. And until the money completely gets cut off, people will continue to spend. And I think that, a lot of it is, people aren't necessarily paying that close of attention to the economy. I mean, they look at their situations around them, and, you're starting to see housing prices stabilize in many parts of the country. The news headlines aren't as dire. And I think one of the major factors was, people were either seeing a really accelerated rate of layoffs a year ago, and that started to slow down a lot. So, you're not necessarily seeing individuals, walk out the door and talk to their neighbors and see that their neighbor got laid off. I mean, right. That slowed down dramatically. And I think last year there was a concern that, your neighbor would get laid off and you'd be next. And I think people have cut back and have their personal balance sheets in a little bit better order,
right.
And so there is an uptick in spending. But when you walk around and you go to, I live in Chicago, and I'll go to walk around neighborhoods, you go past restaurants, and these places are empty mostly. So yeah. Even though you are seeing an uptick in certain areas, and you're not seeing anywhere near the recovery to the levels that we were at a few years ago.
Right. Even though some stocks are hitting 52-week highs, obviously, and some of the stocks, the material stocks, have been doing very well of late. Just make sure don't look at the chart maybe a year ago, because if you just look at it now, it looks really nice. but just kind of close off the left side of the chart. All right. In closing, let me ask you this. Politics and finance, they don't seem to mix very well, but it seems that the administration has a lot of desire to clamp down on a few things, the health care, and whether you're for it or against it is not really the issue here. It's just, the reflection of what happens to markets and the financial regulation and re-regulation of the industry is kind of going back and forth. It looks like there was a big push all of a sudden, and then we don't hear anything. Have you noticed that?
Yeah, I have. I mean, I think there was a big push by Democrats to push through a lot of this regulation, and after some of the midterm election results, they're pulling back and basically trying to almost get out of the spotlight, try to share the spotlight or get out of the spotlight, not be the ones that can have the finger pointed at them. So you've definitely seen kind of a retrenchment here that, it's all about, politics and trying to save your seat and, trying to, I think, save the majority in both the House and the Senate.
Yeah, no, it's pretty, I think this may not be, I don't think I could prove this, but it seems like on a worldwide basis, there is this notion that let's leak the information out. I mean, how many times have you seen from an unidentified source or from a source that doesn't want to be identified in the news somewhere, right? And we used to be like, well, if it's unidentified, I don't want to hear about it because it can't be corroborated, right? These days, we just accept that information. And it's like, well, this is what was said, and then everybody panics about it, and all of a sudden they change it. It's like a testing. It's like they put a little bit of a flavoring out there, and then all of a sudden they change it if the public opinion goes against it. Have you noticed that?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, and I think a lot of it is public opinion, and part of it is testing the market, putting out the trial balloons to see how the market responds, and see if, I mean, because, you know, if you remember when the Relief Act, the $780 million stimulus program, when that was voted down, you know, the markets reacted terribly, and people remember that, and I think, Washington wants to make sure that they don't create a down 5% day in the stock market, and they're very hesitant to come out with ideas or legislation without testing it first to see what the market opinion is.
Have you ever seen a time, do you remember a time that the administration and Congress was so concerned about the stock market?
Not that one that I can recall, but, you know, I've never seen a decline like the one we saw over the past couple of years. So, I mean, you definitely have to take the market into consideration these days, because if the market starts to dive, then it creates a whole wave of concern and panic that hurts consumer confidence. One thing to also keep in mind is that, you know, bears or shorts seize upon these opportunities. I mean, if they can get, you know, shake the market loose a little bit, I mean, you will see shorts attack the market. And, you know, don't think this is a fictitious group of individuals. I mean, if they can make $100 million or $1 billion and be retired, they're not really concerned about the overall U.S. economy and the consequences of short attacks on the market or individual.
But the same goes true for the longs. Longs have been, the last number of months, have been blowing out the shorts pretty well. So, I mean, it goes for both the sides. The short obviously has a bad name to it, and I understand that. At the same time, that I guarantee you, and write this down, as soon as the market really starts moving down and it gets a little bit towards the uncontrollable side, uptick rule is going to be reinstated. You mark my word.
Yeah, I see that coming. And believe me, I don't have anything against, I believe shorting is a healthy part of the market. Mm-hmm. I just know in this last downturn, they were targeted attempts to take down stocks. Shorts were essentially going hunting in packs. And, and there was a feeding frenzy.
Well, the idiot shouldn't have taken down the uptick rule. I don't know what their what was the use of getting rid of that? That was the stupidest thing I ever saw.
I still don't understand. I mean, it makes it easier to trade. It makes it easier to put on a short and, you know, ride a position lower. I think they did the testing, and they felt like it wouldn't create volatility or a lot of issues in the marketplace. But when they tested it, I mean, the markets were pretty orderly at that point.
Yeah, but you got to wonder who was the one with the brainiac idea to even take it off. I mean, who's the guy that said, hey, everything's working out just fine. Everything's great. You know what? Let's get rid of the short tick rule. What the hell?
Yeah. there's a lot of lobbying that goes on for anything that aids financial institutions.
Yeah, no kidding.
So, if you can put together a case study that shows that, hey, this won't actually be an issue unless the world's falling apart when it actually matters as an issue, then, you know, there's a good chance you can get a push through.
I hear you. Damon Southward, who is the head big mucky muck over at briefing.com in terms of the analysts and heading it all up. And we're going to put some links on the website, thedisciplinedinvestor.com, to make sure everybody can check out briefing.com. I am personally recommending this. They don't pay me or anything like that. But I am personally recommending it because this is awesome stuff. This is so many people write me, where do you get your news from? There's great places to get it. Briefing.com is probably one of the best and one of the last remaining that really does this kind of work at the level they do it, and has a great price for individuals as well. So, Damon, thanks so much for joining us on the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
My pleasure.
All right. We'll speak soon. Bye-bye. Okay. So let me just take 2 minutes, 1 minute, actually 10 seconds, and rig this up again. And we're going to get a call in to Das and see what he has to say. All right. We're back with another special guest today, somebody we had on the show before. And I got a lot of great mail on, as a matter of fact, saying that guy was great. And I do agree with you very much. We just call him Das. It's Satyajit Das. And he is he's an expert in financial derivatives, risk management, and capital markets for over 30 years. Das, how are you, buddy?
Good. And how are you?
I'm great, thank you. So lots have been going on since we last talked around the world. We've jumped from the private debt concerns right into sovereign debt, right?
I think that's probably the best way to look at it. I think essentially people lose sight of the basic problem, which is that the world had a lot of debt, has to come down. But what happened was the pain of that in the short run was so great, the governments just stepped into the breach, if you like, and they used their balance sheets to basically bail out, particularly the banks. And I now refer to this as Botox economics, because essentially all you're doing is pumping up everything with a bit of Botox. But the problem is the Botox itself is toxic, the effects are temporary, and essentially you're going to have side effects. So what we are seeing now is strains in the sovereign debt market, because people are asking the question, given tax revenues are collapsing, essentially how are the governments going to pay back this debt?
Yeah, I mean, so this piece that you wrote called The Botox Economy, and let's look at that from the name itself, that, of course, Botox is derived from a very deadly disease, but it's used to make things look better, to smooth out wrinkles, to kind of temporarily, I think that's the main point here, right? Temporarily fix something. And so your whole thesis here is that the things that are being done, the pumping that's going on right now, is temporary. But I guess the question is, with Botox and with your thesis on this, what happens afterwards?
Well, I think you need to look at it in terms of what the Botox that was used. It's essentially loose money in two forms. The first is running zero interest rate policies, pretty much evenly in Europe, in North America, and a few other places. And that's just basically pumping, essentially, amphetamines into the financial markets, because last year we saw essentially everybody chase yield of any kind. And we saw spectacular returns in anything which offered a coupon. I mean, treasuries rallied, and particularly the junkiest bonds rallied enormously. You were getting returns of north of 80% on triple C-rated debt.
Right.
And it was just crazy. And I remember reading an analyst from Morgan Stanley saying he liked the junkiest of the junk, which is kind of a remarkable statement from a reputable investment analyst. So I think that's the first thing of the Botox. The second thing is effectively the spending by the government. Now, the government's essentially, and I've never seen a politician, frankly, who dislikes spending money, and particularly since it's not their money,
right.
It's kind of great.
Right.
And so they also say, we have to step into the breach. You know, it was like almost Shakespearean, we're going to save the world. But people forget that governments have only two sources of money. One is you and me through taxes. The other is to borrow it. And since the economies were weak, and, you know, most of the tax comes from you and me paying income tax, and the income tax receipts were coming down. So essentially, corporate tax wasn't doing much better. So effectively, what happened was they started to borrow. And you can't keep doing that. You just can't keep doing that. Now, and that's the lesson of those two points of Botox, but it's temporary, because the constraint is you can't keep rates at zero forever, because there's a little side effect which, again, is worth focusing on, which is that in most Western economies, there's a large part of the population which is at or near retirement, which means they live off their earnings. And we've seen dividends come down. We've seen interest rate come down. So running zero interest rate policies is great for financial markets in the short run, but ultimately it reduces effectively the income for certain parts of the population. And similarly, governments, I just look at governments in terms of they just reallocate things within the economy. That's all they can do. They can't really drive demand. And so we saw both of these things go in, and now people are saying, hey, the zero interest rate policy can't be continued forever, though I think it'll be continued for a while. And the second thing is the governments themselves are facing constraints about where the money is going to come from. Now, Morgan Stanley published a report which didn't get any press at all, which was remarkable. They said the U.S. had issued $2 trillion of debt last year, but they estimated that only a small fraction of that had to be bought by external investors. Hmm. That's because Uncle Ben, or Helicopter Ben as he's now known, was basically busy buying a lot of bonds. And the other thing was the government had put so much money into the banking system, the banks themselves were big buyers of treasuries as well. So Morgan Stanley's estimate is around about 10 to 20% of that $2 trillion, so between, say, 200 and 400, really had to find a home. But essentially, that can't go on because the quantitative easing programs have ended. So what we saw, essentially, is all those bits of Botox we've injected give a feeling of, I suppose, health. But the core was still pretty toxic and decayed. And gradually, as the Botox runs out, and the governments have a bit left, I have to say, but it'll run out. And then we're going to have to face the reality of a world where the debt has to come down and demand is lower.
Do I have to?
Well, not if you don't want to.
I don't want to. I don't want to. I mean, nor does the government.
There's a very famous line, actually, which is when Frank O'Hara died. He was a famous poet. One of his friends says, "I don't have to believe this if I don't want to." So I think the governments are basically doing exactly the same. And I think this is a desperate gamble. I really do think it's a desperate gamble, which is they were betting everything that low interest rates, all this government spending was going to drive up inflation and growth. And I think what they were gambling on is if you got a bit of inflation, then what happens is the value of those assets, which had tumbled, would go back up,
right. Which
would take care of a lot of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing that would happen is if you get inflation and the economies go along a little better, tax revenues go up, everything gets to go. So it was like almost betting the world on growth. And it was sort of putting all your chips on red on the roulette wheel and spinning it one last time.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is, I'm not sure it's working. I'm not sure it's working at all.
Well, we did see assets go up in value. We'll talk about materials. They did go up in value. We did see stocks go up in value. We have not seen additional jobs put on. And by the way, we haven't talked about this, but I've talked about this on the podcast before. This whole created or saved thing where they talk about creative save 2 million jobs. We know that we're going to see better non-farm payrolls come out over the next number of months because we simply have 1.2 million of new census workers that are going to be hired. So if we just kind of say that they're going to front load that a little bit, and maybe the first month will be 200,000, let's say, and then maybe 150, and et cetera. We're going to see non-farm payrolls probably be in the positive for a while, but again, that's temporary.
You're absolutely right. The employment numbers are fascinating because I think looking at the unemployment headline numbers, as many commentators have pointed out, is now misleading because of the structure of the economy, because we have a lot more part-time workers, casual workers, a lot of contractors. And the numbers that most people look at, which is the U6 number, which essentially is people who are out of work, people who are working part-time but want full-time work or aren't employed, that number is a staggering 16 to 18%. It's been hovering in that range,
mm-hmm.
which I heard Neil Ferguson from England, who wrote The Ascent of Money, basically saying that he actually challenged the audience, saying, "Where's the Great Depression? Unemployment isn't 25." And my response to that would have been, "Well, hang on. Look at the real numbers." So the first thing is employment, as you correctly point out, is weak. The second thing I would say about the employment numbers, which is really scary, is what we've seen around the world, and the U.S. is no exception to that, is people essentially working things like 9-day fortnights or 4-day weeks. And you look at the number of hours worked, which is actually quite fascinating, and you see that number has stagnated around 33 hours a week, which is lower than it has been historically. The other issue is most of the new jobs are temporary, casual, part-time, which means they generally pay less. And obviously, as you correctly say, they can be turned off at any time.
Mm-hmm.
And we're seeing that sort of pattern, which is sort of giving a distorted picture of the employment. But ultimately, I think you have to look through that number to what it's doing to consumption. The U.S. is about 70% consumption. Europe is a little bit less. It's 50 to 60, depending on which country you look at. And if people don't have jobs, they're not going to spend. If people don't have good earnings from their investments, whether it be in the form of interest, dividends, or capital gains, or whatever, they're not going to spend. And the last thing is what people did was borrow against their financial assets or their homes to spend. All three of those have shut down.
Right.
And so it's very difficult to see how you're going to get a recovery. And one of the key things here is people are looking at what I call the rates of change. So, you know, as I jokingly always say, if something falls 50% and then goes up 50%, you're still 25% below where you are. And that's the phenomenon we're seeing. We're seeing things bounce off low levels, but we're not seeing real levels go back. I mean, the classic one is construction in the United States, home construction. The numbers were about half what they were at the peak of 2005, 2006. And people say, "Oh, but it grew by 3% last month." And I'm saying, "Yeah, but look at the absolute level."
Right.
Mervyn King, who's the actual governor of the Bank of England, said it very well. He said, "It's the levels here, stupid. It's the levels.
Yeah, right.
That's what matters here.
it's
not the rates of change."
It's also, you know, the numbers you have to look at. I agree with you. And obviously, you know, numbers off a low base are very small if you use percentages. But we saw that the pending home sales, and I think the new home sales, were down, not this month, but last month in the U.S., down like 16% for the month over month. Did you see that?
Yes, I did indeed.
And then you have the next month, they pop up like 2%. Everybody's excited.
And I think also these things are point estimates. I think you need to look at it over a long period of time, because I think people get very excited about prints of any number these days, because I think it's like drowning people looking for straws. And so, you know, they're basically grabbing onto whatever's good. And it's actually quite funny, you know, I always look at scan the headlines of major newspapers in the morning, and you can see there's two bad items and two good items. And everybody immediately picks on the two good items, and that goes on that the headline and the two bad items are buried somewhere deep in there. I saw that just overnight on the unemployment claims.
Yeah, this is, it's crazy. It's crazy.
Yeah, and I think there's a little bit of delusion, but I think essentially people want to believe that it's going to get better. And look, none of us know for sure, and it's going to play out. But I think the most worrying stress part is that the three things that we had to fix, which is the banking system, is still very vulnerable because commercial real estate will come back to haunt the banking system. The second thing is the real economy in terms of consumption, investment, is still pretty weak. And the third is we now have this problem of the contagion, which is now affecting the government. And it's useful to remember that, you know, we've been passing the parcel to different people. Once you pass it to the government, there's nobody they can really pass it to. They can sort of pass it for a while between each other. But at the end of that chain, there's nobody, unless, of course, the Martians turn up with sort of, you know, truckloads of money. There's nobody else we can pass it to. So we're entering a very fragile and difficult period, I think.
Yeah. And by the way, just to kind of backtrack, I was thinking about this the whole time that you said it was almost like Shakespearean when they were coming to the rescue, that I do recall that when the stimulus package was being done way back when, and there was some kind of jobs package that Representative Ken Jorski, he came on the TV and said, "Everyone, I want to let you know, the cavalry has arrived."
Well, it's a question of whether they arrived at Little Big Horn with General Custer
right.
or not. That's
exactly.
The point.
Exactly. So Das, you let me tell everybody that, of course, he is the author of a book called Traitors, Guns, and Money, and that's available, of course, at Amazon. We'll put a link on the show notes for this episode. But the reason why I bring that up is that it really has to do with the whole idea of credit derivatives, and that's where your specialty was for a while, CDO, structured products, et cetera. So let's delve into this whole Greek tragedy that we have outstanding here. And the one thing I want to ask you is the most recent news item that we've been seeing is this whole idea that there's been some hanky-panky again with Mr. Goldman with regard to hiding some of the debt that Greece had, about $1 billion through CDS exposure, and allowed them essentially to hide that and therefore continue to produce and to then sell additional bonds for themselves over time. What do you think about that?
Well, I think it's actually quite a fascinating process. The first thing is the Greek economy has always been very fragile. It's an economy which really, I suppose, doesn't really produce very much. It lives on tourism. It has a very good shipping industry, but that's sort of not really Greek. It's outside of Greece because it's mainly in Panama last time I looked. And so under those circumstances, the economy was quite weak, and it relied really on low exchange rates. The drachma was always, you know, a basket case. But when they came into the euro, they basically had to meet certain tests. Now, they took a leaf out of another Club Med member, which was Italy. Italy had fudged the figures previously. Mm-hmm. And so what they did was they used derivatives to actually create, I suppose, a borrowing. And it's very simple. What you do, derivatives aren't that complicated. You just exchange one series of payments for the other. Now, any sensible person would do that with the values of the two, at least as you expect them, would be the same on day one. But if you just do one off market, then you create cash inflows or outflows. That's what they did. Now, the first thing you should say is none of this is actually illegal. It's actually quite legal to do it. And if Goldman did it, certainly you can question the ethical basis of doing it, but certainly it wasn't illegal. Mm-hmm. And everybody's been doing this for years. I mean, Enron did it. Everybody's been doing it for years. Now, the fundamental thing was, so when the Greeks got into the European Union in terms of the monetary system, they fudged the figures. And the Greeks, over the last few years, can spend like no other people on the planet Earth, and they have the most bloated public sector. They have basically pension arrangements, which are very generous. So the economy has been unsustainable. Now, the reason it suddenly became a point of question is last year they ran essentially a huge, huge budget deficit, about 13%. Now, that was because of the collapse of the economy after the global financial crisis. Mm-hmm. Now, that in itself, okay, you say, well, that's fine. What? They've got to roll over 50 billion euros worth of debt this year. And as you know, people never really focus on something until somebody asks you to do something. And they looked at this and everybody went, actually, let's have a look at this Greek economy for a change, because, you know, they're going to roll over this money. And everybody went, holy bat, whatever, and went, these guys can't pay. Their tax revenues have collapsed, you know, and they've got these budget deficits of 10, 12% going out into the never-never. And everybody went, maybe we shouldn't buy it. And the Greeks, in their lovely way, effectively tried to fudge it even more. They did a 5 billion euro issue, which in itself, okay, that's fine. Then they told the world that China was going to buy most of it, so all the hedge funds bailed into that and basically thought they could make a quick killing. Then it turned out China knew nothing about the fact that they were buying most of this. And basically the yields on that went from 6.5 to 7.2. And then the Greek government lost all credibility. And then, of course, everybody did what I call the Dubai solution, which is there a big sugar daddy in the background, which happens to be the European Union, which is basically Germany. And they said, well, Germany would bail them out. The problem here is there is no easy fix to Greece. The economy is weak. It was basically pumped up on government spending and borrowing. And they just don't have the underlying productive capacity to pay it back. And the euro complicates this because essentially you can't actually devalue your currency, which is what the old solution for the Greeks would have been. Let the drachma go to hell and we'll get competitive again and we can fudge it through for a couple of more days. What, though, the Greek tragedy, as you call it, actually points to is a really, really scary thing which is going on, which is the thing we started talking about earlier, which is the sovereign debt issue. Because everybody's been putting these balance sheet sovereign debt issues on. Now, if you look at what has come to be called the PIGS, which is Portugal, Ireland, Greece, and Spain, they each have, Portugal has about 177 billion euros, Ireland has about 120, the Greeks have whatever the number is, between 200 and 300 billion, and Spain has close to a trillion euros in debt. And if you throw in Eastern Europe, that number comes to about $2 trillion. And a large chunk of that has to roll. It rolls basically on an average maturity of 5 years, which means every year you've got to roll about $400 billion of that. Now people are saying, hang on, where's the money going to come from to roll this?
Right.
And this is going to, firstly, we're going to see one of two solutions. Either they're going to default, which I think is unlikely in the short run. If they default, then obviously there'll be the whole thing will start all over again. And then it'll be exactly the same as Bear Stearns when Bear Stearns went, well, hey, who's next? And so you looked at Lehman's, and then when you looked at Lehman's, then you look at Merrill's, the whole process will start again. If they don't go under and other people bail them out, that just puts the problem somewhere else. And I think you're going to have to focus on what I have named the fibs, because they've been telling fibs for a while, which is France, Italy, Britain, and the States.
Oh, I like that. Oh, wait. Fibs. I like that.
You like the fibs,
yeah, I like
do you?
The fibs.
So we're going
to
go from the pigs to the fibs.
Yeah, but they don't like you calling them the pigs, but too gosh darn bad for them.
That's right. And pigs are at least useful.
Right, exactly.
You know, I'm not sure fibs are. So effectively, I think you're going to see this problem become one of focus. Now, people in life, you know, I've always said that the poet Eliot was right when he said that mankind can't take too much reality. So they're not going to focus on it very much. So they're going to hope that things get better. And they all use the example of Japan. They say, oh, well, Japan's got debt of, you know, gross debt of 200% of its GDP, and it's fine. Well, that misses the point. Living standards in Japan have been going down for 20 years.
Right.
And the other thing they missed the point is Japan has the largest domestic savings pool in the world, so they can actually fund it a little easier. And, of course, if you want to live with zero interest rates ad infinitum, that helps as well. So I think there's going to be huge focus. So Portugal, Greece, all of these countries are small potatoes. However, what they point to is a structural problem in the economies. And the other issue is, because we've bought up so much government debt in the last couple of years, if we start to see downgrades in these government debts, in other words, the Moody's and S&P people start to look at them and saying, well, hang on, you're no different to anybody else, you can't pay this back. Under those circumstances, they get downgraded, there's no place to hide anymore in terms of putting your money. And that's going to have huge impact.
So the Greek situation, what's troubling to me in that, they're, aside from the fact that they, obviously, as you say, they misrepresented themselves, lied, covered up, did whatever they did to get into the EU. Let's forget about the fact that who is actually doing the auditing. But let's move beyond that for a second, okay? You know, from the EU, in other words. The fact is that they are way outside of the, I guess we'll call it the standards, to be a part of the EU right now. And in a way, by not throwing them out, it does two things. Number one, it obviously helps to support Greece. And, you know, my favorite line of last week or so was when the one of the Spanish, somebody from the Spanish administration came out and said, you know, don't worry, no one will fail. The EU will support their member countries. And I'm thinking, wait, Mr. Spanish fellow, you're one of the problem guys here. Don't you be, how can you be talking about this? You know, kind of how self-serving is that? But the problem is that it lessens, or really severely lessens, the credibility of the euro and the whole process, that they're allowing these countries, and we're just talking about Greece right now, to skirt the rules. To it dilutes the entire quality of the euro. It's like a giant infection inside of it.
Well, you're absolutely correct, because the euro is going to become unworkable under these circumstances. And I think there's two elements to this. One is the euro, yen, and US dollar is now playing a game of pass the parcel, because you can't hold the dollars because you know the problem is there. You now can't hold the euros because nobody is convinced the euro will actually survive or not survive or what form it'll survive in. And the yen, well, we know about Japan. So nobody can hold them. So they're just playing a game of pass the parcel. So you see things like gold going up massively, because to me, gold is just another currency. And people are saying, well, I don't like dollars, I don't like euros, I don't like yen, maybe I like gold. And they decide they don't like gold either, which is creating enormous volatility in currency markets,
enormous.
Which is really not good for growth.
Right.
Because, you know, if you're making business decisions, if you're Airbus or Boeing, and you're trying to pitch for aircraft which are going to be delivered in 2-3 years' time, it's really difficult to price when you don't know what the currencies are going to be.
Right. I mean, it's unbelievable.
It's
and you see 1 to 2%. I mean, I remember when you had a 1% movement of currencies, everybody was like hiding under their desks.
Yes.
I mean, now it's like a regular occurrence.
Well, it's like an occurrence in every 10 minutes.
Yeah, that's
it's
true.
It's just crazy.
That's true.
It's just crazy. But there's a day in 1998 when dollar-yen moved 27 big points. So it moved 27 big figures. So like from 100 to 127. It didn't actually do that. It went up and down.
Right.
And I think at some point in the next 18 months to 2 years, it's quite possible that you'll see dollar, particularly dollar-euro, do a day like that. And everybody says that's great if you trade. I'm saying, yeah, it's great if you trade and get on the right side of it.
Yeah,
it's not
right.
So much funny on the wrong side.
Right.
And for business people who are trying to make long-term decisions, that's not actually very interesting. You know, you might as well go to the casino then and try to bet on what color you want to bet on.
Well,
and
but
you
know, Dustin, sorry to interrupt, but it has multiple effects. Because let's just look at, you mentioned the long-term effects when you're trying to plan for buying and all that. But let's look at the short-term situation. The short-term situation, it plays havoc on the oil and commodities and energy and you know, stock markets. It's there's a direct correlation. The right now, because the euro, even though when we look at the dollar compared to, it's usually a basket, but the euro in particular and the dollar is seeing a gigantic inverse correlation to not only our markets and all, but also to primarily to oil.
Yes, you're absolutely correct. I'll give you another example which reinforces your argument. Everybody's saying the emerging market equity are very attractive. I'm saying, well, yes, that may or may not be true, but a lot of the money, the hot money that's going into these markets is just bet on the currency, which is weakness of dollar, weakness of euro, weakness of yen.
Right.
Because it's far hard to buy some of these currencies because they're restricted. They don't trade freely. So what they're doing is buying equities because you're allowed to buy equities.
Right.
And so you pump up the value of equities to a ridiculous level, which is not the real sustainable value. So when the currency goes down, they bail out of the equities.
Mm-hmm.
So it has nothing to do with the fundamental value of the equities.
Right, and we're seeing that. You're seeing that in Brazil. Brazil's had a crazy volatility lately, and a lot of that has to do with not only their oil holdings, but, you know, it kind of compounds the situation. But then the other thing is that I just don't see how there is a viable future. I mean, I'm really taking this to the end here, but there doesn't seem to be a viable future for the euro, the way that it's currently structured, because there's so many fundamental problems with it.
Look, I think you need to separate out two things. The euro as an economic beast has tremendous problems, but the euro is also symbolic of European Union. And I think the four most dreaded words that the French and the Germans and the Italians will not want to hear is the English telling them, "I told you so."
Mm-hmm.
Because you remember, they did not want to go into the euro because they identified quite correctly some of these problems. So politically, they will have to decide whether to hold this together. And I think people underestimate who the key player in all of this. It's not the politicians. it's the Hausfrau in Düsseldorf. Because she's going to have to write the check to keep essentially this together, because the Germans are very big savers. And there's going to be a political point at which Angela Merkel and any leader in Germany is going to look at Mrs. Hausfrau in Düsseldorf and say, she's going to take the pitchforks and run them through me if I keep doing that. And that's the crucial point. So I think you're going to see a series of things. Firstly, the Greeks will get some money. They'll get some, you know, and the Europeans are very good at fudging. You know, they're very good at fudging things. So they'll fudge a few numbers. They'll do this, and they'll try to keep the thing together for a little bit longer. Then they'll become the trace of, oh, okay, well, what we'll do is we'll have a core euro, which is a few countries, and the other people will fluctuate within a band around it to give them more flexibility. And then eventually they'll have to decide whether that can be worked. So it'll be a series of steps. Everybody's looking for the big move, which is euro to non-euro. But I don't think that's going to be hugely problematic. But the problem is, once you start doing this, what will happen is very quickly everybody will abandon all the pigs and basically move to the core euro countries, which is basically Holland, France, Germany.
Right.
And under those circumstances, nobody else will be able to raise money.
Right.
And so we're going to loop back into the problem, essentially, of the sovereigns being able to fund themselves. And if you have a large domestic savings pool, at least you can bribe, cajole, force people to buy your paper. But when you got to go to international markets, you know, you can't.
Right.
And, you know, you remember James Carville's famous and often quoted thing about the bond market, because he actually said, well, I don't care about what anybody else says, I want to come back as the bond market.
Right,
you can intimidate anybody.
Exactly.
And they're going to come back and do that. So I think it'll be a very complex period, but it's going to be volatile and it's going to be difficult. But I think all these sort of naysayers who essentially for the last 2 years have said the problems are fixed, what's the issue, I think are now going to have to focus on these far more, because we never fundamentally addressed the real issue.
Yeah.
In fact, I would argue we wasted 18 months doing short-term fixes.
Well, let me just say this, that if I could throw in my idea into the mix here, it's, you know, you have this Greek situation and Germany is debating what to do, France is debating what to do. I think that because the sovereign situation has become very similar to the private money situation that we've seen, I think consolidation and takeovers need to be addressed. What do you think?
Oh, well, I think the first thing I said when I heard that Germany was going to bail out the Greeks, I said, I think there are older Greeks who remember the Wehrmacht walking through these streets of Athens, and I don't think that's a very pleasant memory for many
right.
Greeks. So I think it'll be interesting to see how they react to it, which is the point that you're making.
Right.
And essentially, fascinatingly, some people who are much more bullish on Europe than I probably am are now talking about the need for a full political and economic union.
Mm.
So it's actually interesting. They're seeing this as an opportunity not to actually disband the euro, but for Europe to become the United
together.
States of Europe.
Oh, boy. Well, I guess we're going to be seeing gyros made with Wiener Schnitzel.
Well, exactly. I think it could be kind of interesting. So, you know, the Greeks are not going to have, you know, Greek salads. They're going to have sauerkraut.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Oh, boy.
There's not the climate for it, though, I don't think.
No, I hear you. Listen, Das, I want to thank you again for joining us. And I want to make sure everybody picks up his book, Traders, Guns, and Money. He has a variety of places that he can be visited, including, let's see, Euro Intelligence. He writes for Minionville and Satyajit's blog. Give me how this says. I can't do it. I got to get this right.
Satyajit's
Das. Das. Okay, I didn't do it right again. I apologize. But we're going to go back to calling you Das. Thanks a lot for joining me. And all the way from down under in Australia, joining us today on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Great information. I really appreciate all the time you spend with us.
Thank you very much for having me, Andrew.
Right.
Good luck.
Thanks, Das. Bye-bye. Well, as I say, that's a wrap. Hopefully you enjoyed this episode, and we'll see you next time when we talk about your issues on the special 150th episode of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. If you want to check out how we manage money, of course, that 14-minute virtual tour is available. There's a minimum of $50,000 to invest with us, but basically it gives you all the details of how we do, what we do, why we do, and some of the techniques and analysis that we go through. Simply go to thedisciplinedinvestor.com, go to the show notes of this episode, and what you'll find is there'll be links to that and all the information that we discussed today. Until next week, have a great and a profitable week. We'll see you real soon. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.